hey, nobody likes moving. And, you know, Section 8 is not easy to qualify for. So when somebody finds a house that they love, they're going to be sticky. Yeah, you can expect a longer term tenant. If, you know, if you're holding up your end of the deal and the tenant is doing what they need to do, yeah, it should be a good relationship.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Atlanta Real Estate Investor Podcast. I am your host, Spencer Sutton. I am excited to be here with you today, and I've got a special guest with us. We've had him on before when we were talking about areas of Atlanta to invest in. We have our Evernest team leader, Duncan Murphy, with us. So, Duncan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Spencer. Happy to be back.
All right. Well, Duncan is boots on the ground. He is the expert. So anything when we're talking about Atlanta real estate, especially rental real estate investing, we are reaching out to Duncan. He's given us all of the inside information as to what's happening on the ground. So today we're going to focus our discussion around Section 8. So Section 8's, you know, obviously different in different markets. I'm here in Birmingham, Alabama. We do a lot of Section 8 here. It's very popular. So we're going to dive into just some Section 8 information that you may need to know. So if you are considering renting your property out via Section 8, we're going to talk about how you do that. So what's the process? What are the pros and cons? And so Duncan's going to give us that information. But first of all, Duncan, why don't you kick us off by maybe giving us a 30,000 foot view of Section 8 in the Atlanta area.
Yeah. So Section 8, obviously it is a government program. So the US of A really manages kind of their underlying procedures, but every market, just like Birmingham, has multiple different housing authorities. Atlanta is the same. Atlanta having, you know, more counties than Peachtree Roads means that we have tons of housing authorities here. So, you know, we have Atlanta, Marietta, College Park, all over the Atlanta area. And they all do business pretty much the same way. Their procedures are pretty much the same, but they'll have intricacies of their own kind of, you know, flavor for how they process a new participant into a new property. What is their inspection procedure and what are their expectations? But in the end, you know, it's if it's a qualifying participant, a qualifying property, the subsidy should be received relatively the same. So Atlanta doesn't really have too many quirks that differentiate it, but you definitely need to be, you know, at least savvy going into it of what the housing authority is going to expect from me as a landlord. So usually have a lot of resources on their websites. So that's a great place to start.
Awesome. Yeah, that's really interesting because in Birmingham, we do have different housing authorities and each of them behaves a little bit differently, but they're essentially the same. Yeah. So let me ask you this. If you wanted to rent your property to a Section 8 resident, are they in Atlanta? Are they, or in Georgia, are they a protected class? Like, do you have to do that? What are the things that somebody needs to know kind of going into it?
Yeah, so they are not a protected class, given that it is essentially, you know, income related. So it is, you know, we always ask our owners, and depending on kind of the quality of the property, the neighborhood, where you are, we can get a gauge of who's going to come knocking, you know, to rent the property. So that's when we have that discussion. We have plenty of single property owners, plenty of investors who are very hard and fast, yes or no. Four section. Gotcha. But realistically, it is, I think the starting point is to know what the qualifications are for a property on Section 8, because they are going to be a little bit above what everybody knows as code for housing. So having some knowledge there and then just being doing your own homework and deciding whether you do want to have a little bit more, call it micromanagement on your tenant and receiving rent. But you do receive a little bit of benefit of, hey, it should be more consistent if all the boxes are checked each month.
Yep. So we have a lot of investors that come and ask us, you know, should I rent my property Section 8? Should I not rent my property Section 8? And we're essentially giving them advice. And a lot of times we're just talking about the pros and the cons. Like, what are the pros, the things that they need to consider when they think about this? What are the pros to renting Section 8? What are possibly the cons to renting Section 8? Like, I've got my ideas, but I'd love to hear from you. What are the pros of renting to a Section 8 resident?
Sure. Yeah. Realistically, the biggest benefit that I see is that the participant, they have a direct relationship with the housing authority, the government, to receive your subsidy. And they are very dependent on that, right? We've seen some great stories of residents starting on Section 8 and improving and working their way off of subsidy, which is beautiful. Yeah. You know, so, but their agreement, their voucher with the housing authority requires them to meet certain standards. They have to check in with their caseworker every so often. Don't quote me on this, but I believe they, unless they're, you know, physically unable, I believe they have to be in search of bettering themselves to check in with, you know, the status of their family. If they have children.
Like with their caseworker, essentially.
Yes. Yeah, with their caseworker. And I don't know the cadence of that. I know it's at least annual, but they have to check in depending on the family and whether dependents are included and what that might look like. So it does basically add a few more ground rules for a resident. And, you know, if you think about it, can protect the landlord in a way there, because they are, you know, it's not just, hey, I have to make rent, but it's, hey, I have to play by the rules.
I think that's a great point. So there's kind of the initial qualification, essentially running through that process. But then we don't just allow any Section 8 tenant into a property for our tenants. So what additional do we do? Talk about the application process for a Section 8 resident from our standpoint as well.
So from our standpoint, we would underwrite that applicant just the same as any other applicant, except we understand that Section 8 is replacing our income requirement.
Gotcha.
So we still are going to run criminal background. You know, we understand if the employment is not met, but it's, you know, again, it's Section 8 is going to replace that for us. So we're still going to make sure they're a good resident. Section 8 has also done that background check too.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's an important point because, you know, just like there's great private pay residents and not so great private pay residents, same thing applies with Section 8. Like, sure. There are wonderful Section 8 residents, and then there are not so great Section 8 residents. I had a rental house. It was a great house. I think the initial rent was $724. She was on Section 8, and Section 8 was paying $700. She was paying $24, probably for the first year. And every year that the contract renewed, they were paying less and less and less. So kind of like what you said, the success stories, eventually Section 8 literally was paying like $10 or $15 at the end of it. And I was like, man, that is an incredible success story. She was a wonderful resident. So, and I had a great experience in that case, but then you can also have poor experiences as well. So that's the pro. So the pro is they kind of have an initial screening process through Section 8. You're essentially guaranteed. We don't like using the word guaranteed, but you're going to receive that rent on a much more consistent basis. So what are the cons? What might somebody kind of be worried about with the Section 8 process?
Yeah. So, you know, the cons are, yes, there are requirements that the participant, you know, your tenant is now a subsidy or a Section 8 participant. The cons are, what happens when they fall short of Section 8's requirements? Mm-hmm. So the participant can have other income that they're not reporting to their caseworker. They can have an issue of their familial status changed and they didn't report it to the caseworker. So multiple different things that if they, you know, are misleading, then Section 8 will immediately just end the subsidy. And they'll throw their hands up and say, hey, the tenant is yours. You have the lease with the tenant.
So you're sitting there with a tenant in your house.
Yeah, but we're done paying, essentially. Yeah. So it can add that different facet of, okay, now I'm stuck with a tenant who I know is not gainfully employed. And now I have to go through the process of getting my property back. Or if the tenant is trying to move and you want your property back, and maybe they're still on Section 8, well, Section 8 can usually drag out the process of a move out. So if you're trying to get the house empty very quickly, sometimes that can be delayed if Section 8 is facilitating move. That piece, and then really and truly, the Section 8, again, has to qualify the property. So you can definitely expect at least inspections annually. And again, their requirements are above code. So they're their own kind of, you know, bylaws. And oftentimes they can add a pretty big chunk of work that has to be done in order to keep receiving your monthly subsidy payments. So you can definitely expect some more upkeep where, you know, maybe a tenant doesn't mind, you know, the squeaks in the floorboards or whatever they might write up. But Section 8 is going to require that you get it done and require you get it done within a certain time period. So a little bit of additional, you know, management there from them.
So Section 8, essentially what you're saying is you're kind of at the mercy of them keeping that tenant qualified, keeping that resident qualified, and then you're also at the mercy of their inspectors. And it actually can even lengthen the move-in process. So private pay a lot of times can, hey, they can put a deposit down and they want to move in a week. But with Section 8, you've got to get them approved. You have to go through their entire process. They're going to have to do an inspection before the resident can even move in. So, and then I'd say one other potential con or something to think about for an investor is the fact that if you do have a Section 8 resident, yes, you're getting that income every month on a consistent basis. But if they're not working, some of them have jobs and that's awesome. But if some of them, if they aren't gainfully employed, then what they're doing is they're living in that home more, right? So they are flipping light switches more, they're flushing commodes more, there's more wear and tear on that house. So if they stay in there 4 years, then you're probably going to have more at the turn, you're going to have more issues to deal with just because of the wear and tear. I mean, it's a lot like summertime or wintertime when people stay in their houses more. But with Section 8, it could be year-round.
Yeah. And then if an inspector were to write that up, that, hey, the light switches are all, you know, cracked or stained or something, and it's now on my required repair list, you can't fight it. You can't say, hey, that's cosmetic. Hey, that's a nice, you know, would be nice repair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can't fight it. So, you know, having a great relationship, if you are in a Section 8 type leased property, having a great relationship with that housing authority and with that inspector, if you were to meet them, is very important. We had great friends in Birmingham that, you know, we could call on and, you know, they would give us a heads up of inspections. It allows us to run through the property and us do our own kind of fine tooth inspection ahead of time and not jeopardize any kind of rent.
Yeah. We even had a Section 8 inspector who came and worked with us for some time, Wayne, and he was great. Yeah. And he gave us all kind of insight into Section 8, which was wonderful. But yeah. Okay. So that's great. So let's talk about the process for getting someone signed up. Like, what is the process? So let's say you are making your property available for lease with Section 8. You have a Section 8 tenant that's interested in the property, so they fill out an application. So just walk us kind of step by step. What is that process? Because I mentioned there's a move-in check and all this stuff. So let's walk everybody through that. So starting with the applicant and an application.
Sure. Yeah, typically, and we like to do it on our properties, if we know that an owner is not open to Section 8, we're going to put that on the listing.
Right.
Because, you know, if your property is in a specific area, it's in a specific price range, you're going to get attention from Section 8 participants. So it's good to just announce it, whether it is or isn't open to Section 8 applicants, because usually that's everybody's first question, because it is a very time-consuming process and it really, you know, handcuffs the participant if they submit their voucher on a property, because they only have one. So they're going to be very certain of where they want to be and which house it is. So again, our application, they would need to list on there that they are Section 8 participants, and then that replaces our employment and income verification. But we process it just the same. The tenant is, or the applicant is, responsible for their application fee. And they're also, if they are approved, they are responsible for their move-in charges. So the security deposit, anything along those lines. I've never heard that Section 8 reimburses or pays those up. So usually those are always going to be the participant's responsibility. Once they're approved, you're going to hear the word RAFTA, which is short for, it's RFTA, short for Request for Tenancy Approval. And that goes along with their voucher, which is written up depending on their situation of, you know, who's going to be living, who are the dependents, is there any income, you know, basically how much is the government going to support? And it breaks out, you know, here's a total amount of the voucher. Here's the housing authority's subsidized amount. And here's the participant's amount to be paid. And then they have utilities allotted in there and things like that. So you'll see that on the voucher. So if you have your house listed, you know, for $1,500 and an applicant comes with a voucher that's good for, you know, $1,000, I would advise that participant, hey, check with your caseworker. I don't think this is going to be worth your time. I don't think your voucher will support this property, or I'm not going to be able to accept $1,000 for max rent if your caseworker gives that. So check into those numbers before you start the process.
So you want to know. So essentially what you're saying is you want to know what that voucher is for before they get too far into the, before you fill out paperwork on the RAFTA.
Yeah. And all participants, you know, they go through a training. Yeah. Just like Housing Authority, they typically, if you're to sign up as a landlord, I believe they require you do some training. I've seen some of our housing authorities do that just so you're not completely blind to what's coming at you. So definitely ask for the voucher and just make sure it's, you know, it's going to be somewhat reasonable to expect that the voucher or the RAFTA is going to be what you're looking for, what you're asking for in rent. The RAFTA is going to ask tons of questions about who you are, your ownership in the property. Do you have a property manager? Is it landlord owned and managed? And then questions about the property itself, beds, baths, locations, what are the amenities, what appliances come with it, year built, all those things, where it's located, if it's near bus stops, you know, playgrounds, things like that. So can be, you know, at least sometimes 30 minutes to an hour, and we're well practiced. So it can take.
So it might take a landlord who's not experienced with it, could take them several hours.
Yeah, could take a few hours to do that properly. Yeah. But you do all that and you submit it back to the caseworker, to the housing authority, and then they start their process, which is usually, you know, they qualify the property, then they schedule an inspection. So it can go easily 3 to 4 weeks before a tenant's, you know, close to a move-in.
Gotcha. All right. So it can go 3 to 4 weeks. And then in that initial inspection, they could come back with some things that say, hey, this property is not up to our standards. You need to have these things fixed before the resident can move in. Correct? Yeah.
Yes. And you always want to give, you know, that approved applicant, Section 8 participant, you want to give them a fair shake for their RAFTA to go through the process, your house to go through the inspection. But call this another detractor or a con for Section 8. Again, you're hung out there for 4 weeks without any rent income, and you're not really sure if it's going to come in that week five. So with a market as hot as it is today for rentals, you know, you might be able to get a private pay resident in week two of that RAFTA processing. So you definitely need to wait out, maybe get it to first inspection. And if it fails, you have to make that hard decision of whether you give that would-be resident the bad news of that you're going with somebody else.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, at what point, like, let's just take Evernest, for example. At what point during that initial process do we have anything in place that where we say, hey, we're going to give them 3 weeks, and then we're going to reach back out to the owner and say, we need to put this back up? Or do we have anything? Do we talk to the resident, the Section 8 resident, and say, hey, if you're not approved within a certain amount of time, we're going to put it back on the market? Do we do anything like that?
We do. It is, you know, it's not set in stone, just depending on how it's developing. But our goal is 3 weeks. We take it off the market for 3 weeks. We've given everything we need to Section 8. And if we're not hearing back that, hey, your inspection is scheduled, or hey, it's, you know, it's coming ready for inspection in a week or so, that's when we start talking to the owner to say, hey, are you okay with us putting it back on the market? Of course, we're going to let that, you know, that applicant know that we, you know, for the owner's best interest, we have to accept another applicant if they were to come.
Right.
So yeah, we do that for, you know, benefit of who's already done all the hard work, that applicant, and also Section 8. So you don't just burn your bridge with them. You know, we want to give them the chance to follow through.
Awesome. Well, this has been great. I mean, so essentially what we've talked about are the pros and cons, and then the process of how you get somebody through Section 8. What, from my experience, is that, you know, again, you're looking, typically a Section 8 resident is going to be more in the low to moderate income areas of town. But what my experience is once you find a Section 8 resident, they tend to stay there for a while, in my opinion. Like they, I know that I've had ones that have been there for quite some time. I actually had one that was a 9-year resident. I approved her as private pay because she said she was getting on the Section 8 program, but she never qualified for the Section 8 program. So she's just private paid for 9 years, but whatever. But I've also had Section 8s that have been fantastic. And yeah, so Good decisions. I mean, those are tough decisions sometimes, I think, but they could end up benefiting you over the long run. Harder in the beginning, maybe, but better over the long run.
Yeah. Hey, nobody likes moving. And, you know, Section 8 is not easy to qualify for. So when somebody finds a house that they love, they're going to be sticky. They're going to be a long-term tenant because getting a new voucher, submitting a new RAFTA, I mean, it takes numerous months, I believe, for these participants. So you're right. Yeah, you can expect a longer term tenant. If you know, if you're holding up your end of the deal and the tenant is doing what they need to do, it should be a good relationship.
Yeah, there's more demand for these vouchers than there is supply. And so they do not want to get off this program if it's in their best interest to stay on the program. So I agree. Once you find a good one, they're gonna take care of your property and follow the rules. So it could be a great relationship. All right, Duncan. Well, thank you for this. This has been great. And I want to ask everybody, if you've listened to this, listen to any of our other podcast episodes, if you would give us go on to Apple iTunes, give us a 5-star review, let us hear from you. It is great to hear back from people. We do get emails. I know that Duncan was just talking to an investor last week and he was mentioning the podcast. So we'd love to hear those things. But it would be great for other people to also read what you think about the podcast on Apple iTunes because it helps them make a decision. Hey, is this something I need to listen to or not? So that is it for this episode. And we will be back next week with a new episode of the Atlanta Real Estate Investor Podcast.